The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at Brown's Chapel in Selma, Alabama, ironically speaks of dying. 1 month and 3 years later, he would fall to an assassin's bullet.
Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right, he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80. If he's just as dead as 36, as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. He dies. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true. So we're going to stand up right here amid horses. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy clubs. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas. We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up, letting the world know that we are determined to be free.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Acts of Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Should the U.S. Break Up the Big Banks? And the debaters are Richard Fisher, Simon Johnson, Douglas Elliott, and Paul Saltzman.
Now let me go to my point on no increase in safety. Because I don't actually believe that what they're describing would make us safer, even though perhaps in that Churchillian approach, it sounds agreeable to do this, to break up the big banks. We all seem to hate bankers. But it's not actually the right way to go. Think about what would be different. Let's say 10 years ago, if we had broken up the big banks into 20 pieces each, I don't think much would have been different in the crisis that we had. Because these smaller banks that they were broken up into would all have gone the same way. That is, they all would have overinvested in mortgages, both residential and commercial. Now, why do I say that? One, because at the time, almost everybody thought this was smart business. Secondly, you can look at what small and medium-sized banks did. The ones who actually existed that are supposedly safer, they took on tremendous risk and got hurt quite badly. They were just smaller, so they didn't each one of them make the headlines. Richard and Simon imply that smaller banks will take less risk. I don't see it. I don't see it from the incentive structure, and I don't see it from how they actually operated. But let me move on to the conclusion here. Keep in mind, Richard and Simon are selling you a theory. We have no actual experience of breaking up the big banks in this way in advanced economies. They cannot promise success, and I personally believe it will do considerable harm. The economy will be less efficient, credit more expensive, will be less competitive globally, and I don't see an increase in overall safety. Thank you.
Doug Elliott, thank you very much. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is break up the big banks. Now on to round two, and round two is where the debaters address each other directly and answer questions from you in the audience and from me. We have two teams of two arguing for and against the motion break up the big banks. Arguing for breaking up the big banks, Richard Fisher and Simon Johnson, who argue that we're in uncharted territory in terms of the size of the small number of banks that control the assets of enormous amounts of money that they didn't have 15 years ago, that the government protections the fact that they are shielded from failure is a moral hazard that needs to be remedied. The team arguing against the motion, Doug Elliott and Paul Saltzman, argue that the bigness of the banks is not the key issue here, that in the financial crisis we all went through a few years ago, there were many, many factors involved, that breaking up the banks, these big banks, would be a dangerous and unworkable experiment, that basically big business needs big banks, and if we want to be global, we have to have banks that are global as well. I want to go to the team that's arguing against the motion to come back to this term, too big to fail. I just want clarity from the side arguing against the motion. Do you believe that there are banks that are too big to fail, whose failure would indeed be catastrophic?
So let me just be very clear from the outset. No bank should be too big to fail. No company should be too big to fail. Companies, whether they be banks or other financial institutions, need to suffer the risks of their own risky behavior. It's as simple as that.
Here.
So I think we're not debating, you know, and to characterize my position or the industry position as being supportive of moral hazard risk is just misleading. So let's just
make that perfectly clear. But Paul, to my question, does that mean that you do feel that there's a scale of a bank where its failure would indeed be catastrophic?
With Dodd-Frank and the law as it is today, which prohibits bailouts through the new bankruptcy process that allows banks to be resolved without taxpayer support, bank is too big to fail.
I don't mean to harangue you on this question. I think maybe I'm not being quite clear. I'm actually asking for a hypothetical. If J.P. Morgan went down, would that be catastrophic for the economy?
J.P. Morgan can be successfully resolved under the current law and would not need to be bailed out.
Okay, let's go to the other side.
Well, can I just say one thing, if I may?
Yeah.
Paul, you know I love you. You're a good man.
Here it comes.
To make the claim, and I quote, the big banks were stabilizing influences during a crisis. They were the spreaders of the crisis. They were not a stabilizing
Richard, with all due respect,
the
I have
and
to disagree.
And I know because they came to us to ask for protection. Goldman Sachs begged to become a bank holding
know,
company.
Richard, there were many banks that did not need TARP funds. There were many banks that acquired failing institutions at the request of the government to stabilize the market, and frankly, no good deeds goes unpunished. You know, and if we can get back to the point earlier, are you suggesting that we now have only domestic banks? Is that your position, Simon?
Paul, on the crisis that happened...
No, is that your position?
One word, Paul, one word for you, Citigroup. Citigroup was at the center of the financial crisis. Too big to fail became a salient problem in the fall of 2008 because the banks said, they argued with some justification, we've become so big you cannot let us fail. That's when too big to fail really became the problem that we're now trying to confront. So what happened in the last crisis is interesting, no doubt, but it's what happens going forward and how do we deal with the too big to fail institutions that we've created?
Let me put the question back to you that I put to the other side, which is if J.P. Morgan went down, would it bring the whole economy down with it?
Absolutely.
It would jeopardize our
Richard
security
Fisher.
And financial security as well as our economy. And let me just explain how it works. I mentioned the so-called SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions. There's a declaration of who is a SIFI and who is not. That is made by a body chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. That body is inherently political. It is chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. Republican or Democrat, they report to the President of the United States. If a bank that has $4 trillion in assets, if that bank were to be on the verge of some type of failure, do you actually think the Secretary of the Treasury and the body that he chairs, which includes the Federal Reserve Chairman, would let that bank go under, that any president
okay,
would
you,
allow
you've
that to happen?
You've stated a great question,
enormous
and I want to stop you there because I want to let the side answer that question specifically. Do you think that the Fed would let the bank go down?
Doug, yes
do you want
yes
to
or no?
We are a couple years away from having the things in place. I'm willing to wait the couple of years while we get it done. But yes, after Dodd-Frank is implemented in that manner, yes, I do believe it will have become possible.
Why are we a couple of years away, Doug?
Wait.
I don't actually know what Simon's proposal is. And I'm not crystal clear on what Richard's proposal is. Do you want to break up the banks based on size characteristics? Or do you want to go back to a kind of Glass-Steagall, or do you insist on both? What is it you're actually
proposing? In other words, do you just want to shrink all of these banks' balance sheets, or do you want to cut up their functions and separate the different kinds of things they do into different institutions?
What I have proposed, what the Dallas Fed has proposed, what Simon and I are suggesting, is that your exposure as taxpayers should be limited to the commercial banking operation of a complex bank holding company, and that all other aspects of that business are subject to the same risk of anybody that conducts the kind of business, whatever that business may be. And, you know, it doesn't take a meat axe, which is the term you used. The markets will downsize and restructure and reward those who are efficient rather than their having been protected by government guarantees.
Okay. Paul Saltzman.
With all due respect, I think I've heard a concession. Again, I'll go back to...
It's not a concession. You see, in other words, you agree with me.
Or do you not want the government to break up the big banks? That's what we're here debating, Richard.
No, look, listen, all we want is to break up the big banks.
Answer the question.
Yeah, I want the government to set the rules, and I want the market to enforce the breakup.
And I agree with that.
Yes.
Okay.
We won the debate.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
The debate's over.
Simon Johnson, you have the floor.
Look, I want to go back to a very important thing that
Simon
said, which was that we're a couple of years away from something magical happening. Why Why are we a couple of years away? Well, Dodd-Frank passed in 2010. 3 years later, how much of it has been implemented? Relatively little. Why? Because there's been a huge pushback from the industry. Now, I'm merely pointing out that this is an enormously powerful lobby, particularly around these very large banks, that has resisted Dodd-Frank, has resisted the living wills. It's resisted implementing a lot of other measures that would curtail the range of activities and the power of these very large banks.
Simon, Paul, now it's my turn. I love you, okay?
No, it was Richard who loves you, Paul, okay. Not me.
I love you both. Oh, excuse me. Okay, Simon. But why do you insist on continuing to mischaracterize the industry position? I represent the clearinghouse. We have been nothing but constructive in the Dodd-Frank debate. We have supported living wills. We have supported prescriptive liquidity rules. We have spent millions of dollars through simulations and otherwise to try and create a framework in which too big to fail ends. We don't want subsidies. We don't want moral hazard risk. The disagreement is, the proposition on the table is you guys are in favor of the proposition to break up the big banks. And Richard, your proposal is very reasonable, and tomorrow if you want to have a debate about your proposal, let's do that. But that's not what's here tonight. What's here tonight is the proposal on the table for the government, the same government that can't seem to get its act together with respect to anything in Washington. You want them to set arbitrary size limits and break up the big banks. I think that is preposterous.
I want to let you respond, and then I want to move on. Richard Fisher.
Well, the result is to break them up. The proposal that has been made achieves exactly that. So it does achieve the purpose of this debate. I think what we should all propose is that we go for any bank that is too big to fail and make it too small to save. Exactly what the small banks, you were saying that the small banks take the same kind of risk. You're right. You know what happens if they fail? They're shut on a Friday and they reopen on Monday under new ownership and the management is gone, fired, gotten rid of. I just want the same thing for the large banks.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Say it again.
Whoa.
Whoa, 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 Lord.
What?
now back to should the U.S. break up the big banks.
I want to move on to audience questions in a minute. I have one more question to the side that's arguing for breaking up the big banks, an argument that your opponents made that global business demands global banks and that there are businesses that rely very much on the banks now that are massive in scope, that they serve a function, that they became big in part because of the needs of their clients. And I just want to ask Simon Johnson to you to take on that point, and then we'll hear a response from your opponents.
Well, I don't think anyone is proposing that you shrink all the banks down to some very tiny size. As I said, Goldman Sachs was a substantial international bank, one of the best international banks in the world in the mid-1990s. It was less than a quarter of the size that it became at the height of the financial crisis. So that's exactly what we mean by when we say take away the subsidies, break up the banks, the market will sort out the ones who should fail, the ones who should survive. Without those subsidies, John, they will be substantially smaller, and they'll be more competitive globally. You really want big, mega, crazy banks like what the Europeans have? I don't think so.
Well, let's take it to the other side. Paul Saltzman?
I'd just like to read something from the Dallas Annual Report to clarify the point about size. Mega banks, those banks with assets in excess of $250 billion. Under your proposal, you'd break up U.S. Bank. You'd break up Capital One, you'd break up PNC. That's the problem with the proposal. No one has a monopoly on understanding what the right size is. So I think, which is it? Is it $250 billion? Is it $500 billion? Is it $1 trillion? That's the problem. The size of these banks are determined by the marketplace.
Hello, I'm John Donvan, moderator of Intelligence Squared U.S. Join us online at iq2us.org to vote on the motion and keep the debate going. I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. Welcome back to the program.
Let's go to some audience questions, sir, right down.
Scott Shea, for the opponents, you've mentioned the consolidation of the rest of American industry, and you said the banks are consolidating in the same way. Couldn't it be the causation goes the other way, that the immense overconsolidation of the banking industry has caused the rest of the economy to follow in its wake and has raised the brittleness of the U.S. economy, decreased job formation, made middle market lending harder to achieve and harder to get because the big banks are indeed so big?
Let's let the side arguing against the motion to break up the banks answer that.
Yeah, banks mirror Paul society. Saltzman. Society don't mirror banks. Banks serve customer needs. IBM doesn't have businesses in 170 countries because JP Morgan exists. So I would say it's exactly the other way. Business is becoming global. Small businesses are becoming global, and banks service their needs. The other concept I'd like to get on the table is economies of size, scope, and scale. If you pay $1 million for a computer and you have one customer, you have to charge that person $1 million. If you have 1 million customers, you get to charge that person $1. It's pretty simple. Over the past 5 years, you have enormous technology expenses that need to get spread out over a large customer base. That is in large part why banks have become are getting larger and larger, because of those global and technology needs.
Would this side like to respond? Yes, Simon Johnson.
When I talk to the CFOs of large international corporations, the people who run the financial side of those businesses, non-financial corporations, I ask them, do you want to have one big global bank handling all your financial operations everywhere in the world? It's a fair question. And they say, no, we don't. What we want is different providers in different places. But the idea we would single source all of our credit, all of our financial transactions, that's actually a bad idea. So the idea that the big or international business somehow needs colossal, at this scale, international banks is a complete fallacy.
Gray jacket. And remember to stand up and tell us your name, please.
Okay. My name is Jessica Bloomgarden, and my question is for the against side. You guys have been very focused on making the debate around the size of banks and asset size, and I thought Richard's proposal around the division of function and sort of a Glass-Steagall type proposal was really interesting, and I feel like you haven't addressed that, so I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Be happy to give you some thoughts, and I will in 1 second. The only reason we've been so focused on the other point is that is the actual point of the debate. And it's kind of a sleight of hand to say, we think that once you do this thing, it will change the whole economics so much that we know that it will achieve the same effect. I understand there's an argument for it that's far from proof.
I want to remind you that we're in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator. We have four debaters, two teams of two, arguing it out over this motion, break up the big banks. Sir.
Hi, I'm Karthik Reddy, a student at Blair, and this question
So what your student at Blair, tell us about Blair for just a second.
Well, Blair's
there's a whole group of you here?
Yeah, there's a small group of us here right in the middle.
Are you the debating team?
Yeah, well, two of us are captains of the debating team, and it's a, yeah.
Congratulations, thanks for coming.
So can we draft him at this point?
This question is for the four side, and in the scenario that you've proposed of the splitting of the big banks, how do you think the market will react to the splitting of these economic giants?
I think the market would greet it with great applause, and I'll tell you why. Because the market would then gravitate to those that are the most efficient deliverer of services and all the services these gentlemen speak of, rather than just assuming that they can conduct business with them because they're totally safe at all times. Only the most efficient would survive. And by the way, it may be that XYZ Bank competes better than anybody else and has that business. That's fine with me. But I do not want to risk another penny of taxpayer money to bail them out when they make a big mistake. And it'll happen in bigger size, and it may well happen before the waiting period that this gentleman mentioned.
Doug Elliott.
Yeah, just want to say we agree with you on the objective. We don't agree with you that what you're proposing will achieve that objective.
Another question?
I have a question for Richard and Simon. So you're saying that these banks are all global in nature, and you're proposing to break up the U.S. banks. But how would you handle international banks like Barclays, who have both commercial, retail, and investment banking divisions? How would they operate in America?
One of the arguments you always hear is, we have to be big because the others are big, and if not, they will dominate the world. That was the argument made that the Japanese banks were going to dominate the world, Nomura, et cetera. Or the French banks would dominate the world. It hasn't happened. It doesn't happen because they grow to such a size and scale that they're unmanageable. I don't fear international competition. I want to just be the best at what we do. I want to make sure that our taxpayers are protected so that we don't get driven into the tank like we were before. And I do believe that we can be internationally competitive just by being outstanding.
Sir, right in the center there.
I'm Mendel Lazarus. I'm a senior at Yeshiva University and accounting student. Just came to watch the debate. I had a question for Richard and Simon. And we've mentioned several times the complexities of these large banks, specifically J.P. Morgan, $4 trillion in assets, $80 trillion in these incredibly risky derivative swaps. In a sense, yeah, you're right. These are incredibly risky things that are so colossal. You're suggesting breaking all of this up? Who exactly do you think it is that's going to pick up the pieces and make this all function in a smoother way?
Richard Fisher.
A more efficient operator that doesn't need to be subsidized to operate will pick up that business. Let me give you an example. There are huge hedge funds that manage derivatives. With each increase in the risk position they take, they have to post greater margin. That does not occur at the XYZ banking institution you mentioned before. Why should they be different than why should they have different rules apply to them that are applied to everybody else in the industry? When you place your own capital at risk, you should be subject to the same rules as anybody else who takes an at-risk position. That's all we're advocating. And I'm sure, and I know, there are others that would take up those positions that were sound and replace the positions that that institution will have. But that's because they're better and more efficient operators, and they don't operate with a subsidy.
Coming up next, James Watson Girard. Here is part of the speech he gave on November 25th, 1917. He served as American ambassador to Germany prior to the U.S. involvement in World War I.
I know that it is hard for Americans to realize the magnitude of the war in which we are involved. We have problems in this war no other nations have. Fortunately, the great majority of American citizens of German descent have, in this great crisis of our history, shown themselves splendidly loyal to our flag. Everyone had a right to sympathize with any warring nation. But now that we are in the war, there are only two sides, and the time has come when every citizen must declare himself American or traitor. We must disappoint the Germans who have always believed that the German Americans here would risk their property, their children's future, and their own necks and take up arms for the Kaiser. The foreign minister of Germany once said to me, "Your country does not dare do anything against Germany, because we have in your country 500,000 German reservists who will rise in arms against your government if you dare to make a move against Germany. Well, I told him that that might be so, but that we had 501,000 lampposts in this country, and that that was where the reservists would be hanging the day after they tried to rise. And if there are any German Americans here who are so ungrateful for all the benefits they have received that they are still for the Kaiser, there is only one thing to do with them, and that is to hogtie them. Give them back the wooden shoes and the rags they landed in and ship them back to the fatherland. I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras. And in all these mountains, there is no animal that bites and kicks and squeals and scratches that would bite and squeal and scratch equal to a fat German American if you commenced to tie him up and told him that he was on his way back to the Kaiser.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.